Chapter 25. "Today is the day," Paul Trout said with steely determination. Trout stood wide-legged in a dinghy while he handed fishing tackle to his wife, Gamay, who was aboard their 21-foot powerboat. Gamay set the rods into a rack and said, "Ho-hum," bringing her palm to her lips in an exaggerated yawn. "I recall the same male bragging 24 hours ago on this very same spot. It was an empty boast, just like the day before." Trout climbed onto the boat with surprising agility for a man built like a professional basketball player. Although he was 6'8", he moved with a cat-like grace that came from years of experience on boats at the side of his fisherman father. He punched the starter button on the console. The inboard engine came to life with a throaty grumble and a puff of blue exhaust. "No brag. When you're born into an old Cape Cod family that's caught tons of fish over the decades, you expect an off day once in a while." He stuck his nose in the air like a bloodhound. "That granddaddy striper is waiting in his honey hole for me to hook him." "Now I know why fishermen have a reputation for telling tall tales." Gamay cast off the mooring line. Trout gave the throttle a light touch and steered the boat at a slow speed across Eel Pond toward the Water Street drawbridge. They passed a bar whose deck overlooked the pond, and Trout smacked his lips. "I can taste that cold, frosty beer." "Let's jack up the ante," Gamay said. "Loser buys dinner, too." "It's a bet," Trout said without hesitation. "Fried clams go great with beer." The boat proceeded slowly under the drawbridge and out into the harbor, past the Martha's Vineyard ferry terminal and the research vessel Atlantis, which was tied up to the dock of the world-famous Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, where Trout's interest in oceanography had been stimulated when he was still a boy. The boat cleared the harbor and Trout goosed the throttle. The bow angled up on plane, and he steered toward the Elizabeth Islands, an archipelago that lay in a string southwest of Cape Cod. Gamay puttered about the deck, readying fishing gear. There were few things better, in Trout's opinion, than racing over the waves with the salty breeze in his face and the prospects of a full day of fishing. All he needed to make the outing a perfect 10 would be to catch a bigger fish than Gamay. He was used to friendly competition with his wife, but he had been quietly annoyed that she had outfished him over the last 2 days. As a young girl growing up on the shores of Lake Michigan, Gamay was no slouch when it came to boats and fishing. Although she had grown into an attractive woman, she retained a hint of the tomboy she had once been. Her good-natured taunts at Trout's lack of success ran counter to his understated New England persona. He gritted his teeth. Today damn well better be the day, or he would never live it down. Near the low-lying hump that was Nashon Island, Trout pointed the boat toward a cloud of squalling seabirds, diving in the water in search of bait, being chased to the surface by larger links in the food chain. Amorphous yellow blobs were popping up on the screen. There was a fishy scent in the air. He cut the engine and the boat plowed to a stop. Gamay handed Trout a fishing rod and took the wheel. It was customary for the highliner on the last trip to let the lowliner go first. Trout settled into the swivel chair and let some line out. He started jigging, continuously jerking the rod to keep the lure traveling through the water. "Fish on," he yelled. He cranked the reel and pulled in a 32-inch long striped bass. After measuring the fish, he threw it back. Gamay quickly caught a 28-incher. Again, they tossed the fish overboard. They took turns catching stripers in roughly the same size range before the school played out, and they moved to another spot that was equally as productive. They kept a running compilation and were in a dead heat when Trout felt a sharp tug on the line that almost pulled his arm out. This was going to be the tiebreaker. He was barely aware of a cell phone chiming. Gamay put the phone to her ear and, after a moment, said, "Kurt needs to talk to you." Trout cranked the reel like a man possessed. The silver body of a huge fish flashed near the surface. Damn. It was as big as a whale. He tried to concentrate. "Tell him to wait," he shouted over his shoulder. "He can't wait," Gamay said. "He and Joe are on their way to Turkey." Turkey? The last Trout was aware of, Austin and Zavala were off Newfoundland. In that instant, Trout lost his train of thought and the fish. The line went slack. Oh, hell. He got up, handed the rod to Gamay, and took the phone in exchange. "Hope I'm not interrupting anything," Austin said. "Nah," Trout said. He stared disconsolately at the ripples where he'd last seen the giant striper. "What's up, Kurt? Can you come up with a computer model that will reconstruct a transatlantic ship voyage? I know it's a tall order." "I'll give it a try," Trout said. "I'll need a date. I can figure in currents, weather, and speed if that information is available." "Actually, very little is available. This was a Phoenician ship. The crossing was made around 900 BC. Trout was more intrigued than discouraged. "Tell me more," he said. "I've sent you a package by special courier. Should be there by now. It will explain everything. This is urgent. I'll call first chance I get. Bye." "What was that all about?" Gamay said after Trout clicked off. He explained Kurt's requests. They would have to call it a day. He stared longingly at another cloud of wheeling seabirds. "Damn shame about that fish." Gamay pecked him on the cheek. "I saw him. It was a monster. I think it's my turn to buy the beer." The package from Austin was leaning against the front door of the 200-year-old Cape Cod cottage that overlooked a circular kettle pond. Trout had grown up in the broad-roofed house within walking distance of the Oceanographic Institution, whose scientists had encouraged his boyhood curiosity about the ocean. He and Gamay sat at the harvest table in the kitchen, munching on the ham and cheese roll-ups they had prepared for their picnic lunch as they went over the Jefferson file. At one point, Gamay looked up from her reading and blew a strand of dark red hair out of her eyes. "This is unbelievable." Trout took a swig from a can of Buzzard's Bay ale. "I'm trying to figure out what we can do. My experience with computer modeling is mostly deep-sea geology. You made the switch from nautical archaeology to marine biology. We could pull something together, but it wouldn't be pretty. We'll need help." Gamay smiled, showing the slight space between her front teeth, a dental anomaly that somehow looked attractive on her. "Didn't we hear some gossip last night?" Trout recalled the gentle ribbing he had received from the local barflies who had heard about his fishing contest with Gamay. Then he remembered someone mentioning a familiar name. He snapped his fingers. "Charlie Summers is in town." Gamay handed Trout the phone and he called the research vessel dock. He got through to Summers, who was working on a retrofit for the Atlantis, and laid out the problem. "That's a lot more interesting than what I'm doing," Summers said. "Can you come over now?" Minutes later, the Trouts were walking out onto the research vessel dock. A stocky man with a square jaw and thinning straw-hued hair greeted them with effusive hugs. Summers was a well-known naval architect who specialized in the design of research and educational vessels. He often consulted in the design of luxury yachts and was an expert in the stability of large sailing vessels. He gave Gamay a big wink. "Thought you two would be out fishing today." "News of our competition got around fast," Trout said with a smirk. "It's the talk of the town. You know how gossipy fishermen and scientists are."
"Paul almost beat me today," Gamay offered.
Summers roared with laughter. Please don't tell me it was the one that got away. He wiped the tears from his eyes. Now what's all this about Phoenicians? Trout jumped at the chance to change the subject. We got a call from Numa this morning. Someone is doing research on pre-Columbian contact and needed help replicating a voyage. We get a lot of odd requests. Not odd at all. I've read reams of material on Phoenician shipbuilding. There's no doubt from a naval architect's point of view that they had the capacity to go almost anywhere they wanted. Then you can help us plot a course, Gemay said. Summers shook his head. That's a tough one, he said. The Phoenicians left no maps or charts. They guarded their sea knowledge with their lives. Noting the disappointment in Gamay's face, he added, But we can take a stab at it. Let's go build us a ship. Summers led the way into a brick building where he had his temporary office. He sat behind a computer and clicked off the schematic diagram of the Atlantis that had been displayed on the screen. I see we're going to build a virtual ship, Trout said. That's the very best kind, Summers said with a grin. They never sink, and you don't have to worry about mutinies. He called up a computer file, and a drawing of a square-sailed vessel appeared on the monitor. Is that a Phoenician ship? Gemay said. This is one type, based on pictures from vases, sculptures, models, and coins. It's an early design. It's got a keel, rounded hull, oars, and a high seat for the steersman. We're looking for something capable of deep ocean travel, Trout said. Summers leaned back in his chair. Their ship designs were modified by need. The Phoenicians graduated from shore coasting and stops at night to long, uninterrupted voyages. I'm going to use a software program developed for some architects doing research in Portugal and at Texas A&M. They created a methodology to test and evaluate the sailing characteristics of ships where no plans were available. The goal was to come up with a comprehensive image. They used Portuguese naus, the trade ships that sailed from Europe around Africa to India and back. Watch. Summers bent forward and clicked the mouse. A computer-generated image of a 3-masted ship appeared on the screen. Looks like a ghost ship, Gemay observed. This is only the foundation. They fed the info from a wreck survey into a computer. Using the software, they developed plans for the ship's rigging, sails, and spars. The picture is one of those images. By coming up with a hypothetical reconstruction of the ship's hull, they figured out how the ship performed at sea and in adverse weather. Once they had that mathematical model, they could test it in a wind tunnel. And you can do the same for a Phoenician ship, Trout said. No problem. We'll use 3 known Phoenician wrecks that were found in the western Mediterranean and off the coast of Israel. The ships were upright and perfectly preserved in cold water. We used the Jason, the same remote-operated vehicle that photographed Titanic, to come up with a photo mosaic. I programmed the specs into my computer. A set of drawings that looked like blueprints for a shipbuilder filled the screen. The drawings showed the ship as seen from above, the side, and head-on. The plans indicate the ship is only 55 feet long, Trout pointed out. This is a composite of the Israel ships. I'll add some length. I tweaked the program so that it will automatically add in design features that would have evolved with the increase in the ship's size. A skeletal, 3-dimensional image appeared, outlining the ship's timbers and other structural elements. The spaces between the timbers began to fill in. Decks, oars, rigging, and sail materialized, along with a ramming beak on the prow. The last feature was a carved horse head on the bow. Voila! A ship of Tarshish. It's magnificent, Gemay said. The lines are functional yet graceful. She would be around 200 feet long, as I reckon, Summers said. That ship could go anywhere in the world. Which brings us back to our original problem, Trout said. How do we figure out that vessel's transatlantic routes? Pursing his lips, Summers said, It's possible to back into a solution like those guys did with the Nauu. You'd need wind, current, and weather patterns. Work in the ship's probable speed, figure out the pilot's choices according to ship design, and then factor in historical accounts. Gemme let out a heavy sigh. We've got a lot of work to do. Summers glanced at his wristwatch. Me too. They want the Atlantis ready to sail in 3 days. The Trouts thanked Summers and walked back along the main street of Woods Hole.
Where do you think we should go from here? Gemme said.
Tough to say. Kurt only gave us a few crumbs of information. He's not going to be happy, but I don't think we have enough to pull this thing together. We may need another approach. Like many married couples, Paul and Gemme had a way of anticipating each other's thoughts. Their work for the NUMA Special Assignments Team, where unspoken communication could mean the difference between life and death, had honed their skills to a sharp edge.
I've been thinking the same thing, Gemme said.
Every sea voyage starts on land. Let's go through the Jefferson file again. There may be something we missed. Back at the house, they sat at the kitchen table, read half the file, and then exchanged the sections. They both finished reading at about the same time. Gemme put the papers down and said,
What pops out at you?
Meriwether Lewis, Trout said. He was on his way to tell Jefferson what he had found when he died.
That intrigued me, too.
She riffled through the papers in front of her. Lewis had material evidence he wanted to show Jefferson. I suggest that we try to figure out what happened to it. Might be almost as tough as reconstructing a Phoenician voyage, Trout said.
There's a nexus that might help us, Gemme said.
Jefferson was president of the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia. He sent Lewis there to prep him in the sciences for his historic exploration. While Lewis was in Philadelphia, Jefferson devised the cipher for them to use. Trout blinked his large brown eyes in a barely noticeable show of excitement and picked up the thread. Jefferson wrote to members of the society to tell them about his Indian language research and the theft of his papers. He contacted a society scholar who identified the words on the vellum map as Phoenician. The artichoke file was found at the society.
That's better than Kevin Bacon's 6 degrees of separation, Gemme said.
She looked through the file and found a number for the Philosophical Society and the name of the researcher who had discovered the file. She called Angela Worth, identified herself, and made an appointment to meet the next day. As Gemme hung up, Trout grinned and said, You realize our vacation has come to an end.
That's okay, Gemme said. I think I'm getting tired of fishing.
Trout gave a weary shrug of his shoulders. I know I am, he said.